Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. In his classic 1972 Art Forum essay, critic Lawrence Alloway described the art world as a network. Taking cues from Alloway's observation about the nature of art production in the 1960s and 70s, John A. Tyson proposes that the era's portfolios of printed multiples can be understood as network co-productions. In this lecture, recorded on April 3, 2017, as part of the Works in Progress series, Tyson historically contextualizes a selection of collective projects from the National Gallery of Art's holdings, Wallace Ting's One Cent Life, 1963, the Wadsworth Athenaeum's X plus X, 10 Works by 10 Painters, 1964, curated by Sam Wagstaff, Jr., gallerist Leo Castelli's multimedia 10 from Leo Castelli, 1968, William Copley's serial boxed magazine, SMS, February-December 1968, and finally, Experiment in Art and Technologies, EATs, the New York Collection for Stockholm, 1973.
Artwork as network, printed multiples and the cybernetic turn. In a classic 1972 Art Forum essay, critic and curator Lawrence Alloway described the art world as a system. He affirms, quote, "Art is now part of a communications network of great efficiency." Taking cues from Alloway's observation about the nature of art production in the 60s and 70s, I propose that the era's portfolios of printed multiples can be understood as networked co-productions. I will historically contextualize a selection of collective projects from the National Gallery of Art's holdings. Wallace Ting's One Cent Life of 1964, the Wadsworth Athenaeum's 10 Works by 10 Painters of 64, curated by Samuel Wagstaff, Jr., gallerist Leo Castelli's multimedia 10 from Castelli of 1968, William Copley's serial boxed magazine, SMS, or Shit Must Stop, from February to December of 1968. And finally, and I'll spend the longest on this, Experiments in Art and Technologies, or EATs, the New York Collection for Stockholm from 1973. These portfolios consist of works in a variety of traditional and non-traditional artistic media, from poetry to silkscreen to plastic sculpture and even vinyl records. While in some cases quite lavish, the projects are not particularly rare. In parts or wholes, they are in many museums' holdings. However, perhaps due to their delicate nature and requirements for audience interaction, they've received limited attention from scholars, or typically have only been individually discussed or displayed publicly. And I'll just show one of our examples from 10 from Leo Castelli. But I think, in fact, here it's actually a really wonderful act of curation that colleagues in DCA have done, because it's in very close proximity to works by Marcel Duchamp, who we'll discover as a major influence on these box sets in the 60s and 70s. So Mike Mizell's Edged in Black, selections from SMS at Wellesley College's Davis Museum, and Broadway 1602's The New York Collection for Stockholm Portfolio are notable recent exceptions to this singular exhibition rule. Additionally, perhaps because they transcend a single style or tendency and are easier to break apart, they have generally not received the same degree of attention as the related Fluxus editions that George Matunas organized between 1962 and 78. Which were surely an influence nonetheless. So today I'll briefly propose a selection of lenses to analyze the general operations of the aforementioned portfolios, and then conclude with a longer discussion of EAT's project, upon which I've conducted the most research. Multiplication madness, situating prints and multiples in the mid-century. The 60s was marked by the rise of the so-called print renaissance and the founding of new print workshops, such as Crown Point Press or Gemini GEL. The renewed interest in printmaking catalyzed the production of portfolios authored by various artists, both with works on paper as well as objects in other media. A democratizing thrust undergirded the creation of many multiples and portfolios. Barbara Kulicki, a partner in Multiples Gallery and the Betsy Ross Flagg Company, described her goals to the New York Times in 1969, quote, "We'd like to take the snobism out of art collecting. We hope to make art available to those who can't afford major works. There's nothing new about the concept of multiples. Graphics have been around for a long time," end quote. Artist Carl Gessner, who along with Daniel Spori was behind the European Multiples edition Mott, stated earlier the same year, coinciding with Mott's launch in America, quote, "We'd even like to get stuff into supermarkets, and there's no reason why people should think of original art as something beyond them." As Gerstner's words suggest, accessibility meant a drift toward other commodities. And of course, this is a logic that's common to pop art, and that may in fact account for the reason why there are so many pop multiples at this time. Thus, a desire to tap broader art markets drove multiplication too. Spori, the creator of Mott, described himself as an art pusher, implying that his edition Mott was a kind of gateway drug. In an article of the same year entitled Art Over the Counter, Time magazine used a pharmaceutical metaphor to report on a recent trend. Retailers like Sears Roebuck and E.J. Corvette Incorporated had just opened art divisions. And in the first edition of SMS, the artist Julian Levy created a series of art prescriptions that were accompanied with four plastic pill casings, which the users, I guess, could fill with whatever substances they wanted. A primary tension that has always haunted prints seems to have heightened at this time. Should they be appreciated for their aesthetic and material qualities, or for their capacity to publicize and deliver information from elsewhere? In 1953, print curator at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, William Ivins, published Prints and Visual Communication. This text emphasizes the medium's property as a mode of information transfer over techniques' artistic values. Ivins's book was a major influence on Canadian media theorist Marshall McLuhan, author of the Duchamp-inspired The Mechanical Bride, The Gutenberg Galaxy, Understanding Media, and the punning The Medium is the Massage, or Mass Age, or Message, which you can see was also a multi-channel endeavor and issued as an LP. McLuhan was the leading voice in popularizing cybernetics and theorizing the effects of old and new media, which he argued work over, or massage, audiences in distinct fashions as they are transmitted and received. Moreover, the period in which these printed multiples were produced is largely coextensive with the 6 years, 1966 to 72, that according to critic Lucy Lepard, the art object underwent a process of dematerialization. Lepard states, quote, "For artists looking to restructure perception and the process-product relationship of art, information and systems replaced traditional formal concerns of composition, color, and technique," end quote. While a number of figures central to most accounts of conceptual art, such as Joseph Kosuth, Lawrence Wiener, Hans Hacke, made multiples for these editions, traditional formal concerns were not discarded by everyone involved. All of these projects negotiate concerns for materiality, as well as a desire for decentralization and dematerialization. And even in this conceptual project, particularly of Kosuth, the act of unfolding it, making this Kosuth turn into a small sculpture that resembles the Brazilian artist Ligia Clark's Bichos, seems to be very much part of the process of engaging it. So, tangled legacies between Duchamp, constructivism, and the Bauhaus. Marcel Duchamp's deluxe hand-painted boxed set artwork, the Boîte en Valais, which was issued in various editions during the era, likely provided additional impetus for this for trends in presentation and distribution. Duchamp described his Boîte in the following manner, quote, "I thought of the idea of the box in which all my works would be mounted like a small museum, a portable museum, so to speak," end quote. The portfolios are not all miniaturizations of a single author's artworks located in brick-and-mortar institutions. However, Duchamp's insights hold for many multiple portfolios. Furthermore, Duchamp's rotoreliefs, first issued in 1935, multiple op prints intended to be viewed on a turntable, and also the materials he used for his film Anemic Cinema, were also reissued various times in the 50s and 60s. And a hand-powered version of one of the text discs from his film came screwed into an issue of SMS. And we can see Duchamp's self-awareness, right? So he's a guest plus a host equals a ghost. So he too, like McLuhan, likes puns, but also has some sense that perhaps his influence is haunting many artists at the mid-century point. So in addition to channeling Duchamp, many of the projects were understood to form part of a tendency to resuscitate constructivist and Bauhaus modes of facture, connections that seem somewhat surprising today. Understood through the prisms of L. Lissitzky's The Constructor, newfangled plexi constructions by Naum Gabo, or Moholy-Nagy's multiple enamel constructions or telephone paintings, period writers emphasized artists and workshops' removal of the hand of the artist, division of artistic labor, the importance of craft or technique, and the bridging of the art-science divide with new media. For example, in his constructivism, George Ricci describes diverse practices seemed compatible at the time. Ligier Clark, Hans Hacke, Naum Gabo, and Larry Poons were all constructivists. The game of tabletop curation, the phenomenology of the multiple. As Duchamp signaled, these portfolios possess the logic of virtual exhibition. While designed for domestic consumption and composition, in a number of cases, the series were selected by gallerists or museum curators. Hence, at the least, the collector viewer becomes a co-curator of sorts. Additionally, the experience of unpacking and playing with the printed matter is certainly part of the message. Print historian Susan Tallman dubs 1 Cent Life the decade's most important livre d'artiste. She calls it equal parts, quote, expressionist tradition and pop irreverence. 1 Cent Life is an unruly collaboration between poet and artist Wallace Ting, an artist working both in post-painterly abstraction as well as pop idioms. From editor-contributor Sam Francis, to Alan Caprow, to Asger Jorn, to Andy Warhol, and it additionally included material culled from ads, which is what's in the middle. Unpacking, peeling back layers, and paging through the boldly colored folios is a sensory delight, if not perhaps a sensory overload. The project explodes usual word-image relations. Here, illustrations are by no means subordinate to the texts that host them. Although the pages are organized via standard paratextual elements, pagination and a table of contents, pathways are opened up because the pages are not bound. New forms of readership are available. Users can dethrone the authors and reconfigure the book. Pulling sheets out and crossways, for instance, reveals examples of the same chromatic palettes pronounced in distinct visual idioms. A more regular rhythm of spectatorship emerges with Wagstaff's 10x10, in which sheets with printed names sheath each print. Conversely, SMS introduces a sense of playtime into spectatorship. Many projects need to be set into motion or powered in some way by spectators. So I already mentioned Duchamp's work. This is a tape recording by Bruce Nauman, a kind of instant film that you would spin by Hollis Frampton. And then here, Roy Lichtenstein's hat, of course, has to be worn. In both 10x10 and SMS, psychedelic neons that could be found on contemporaneous concert posters appear. Frank Stella's first silkscreen here hums with great intensity. Various contributors to SMS employ Day-Glow paper stock with great aplomb. Seeing them on the screen pales in comparison to the experience of sifting through or turning over folios and cards, and getting the pleasant surprise of a splash of color between the otherwise more drab materials. Indeed, many of the fluorescent papers are so powerful that they cast colored halos onto tabletops or surrounding sheets. One particularly remarkable instance comes in John Giorno's Chinese card game, where glossy blacks juxtapose potent blues, greens, and pinks. The work poetically collides a Chinese restaurant menu, I Ching chance operations, American tragedy, and childhood tabletop pastimes. Multiplying the site. While scaled to tabletops, these multiples had a wide range of distribution. Hence, scale is not manifest so much in the big canvas described at the time by art historian E.C. Goossen or viewed in contemporaneous earthworks, but in terms of its reach of many publics. Certain components of SMS possessed a kind of site specificity, such as Yoko Ono's Men's Piece for John, which required a collector-performer to break a favorite cup and glue it back together. In the cases of 10 by 10 and 10 from Leo Castelli, prints and multiples expanded specific institutions to sites beyond their walls. At the time Wagstaff produced the portfolio, he was curator of paintings at the Wadsworth Athenaeum. On the colophon page, he asserts, quote, "This portfolio was commissioned and printed in an attempt to extend as much of the visual impact as possible of 10 artists to paper and make these prints available to collectors who might not otherwise have had such a vivid slice of the artist." He tells us it's by dint of the flatness they share with paintings that these works give some sense of the experience of viewing canvases. 10 from Leo Castelli suggests that the diverse works are both a missive and a gift from the gallerist, and apparently underscores the creator's allegiance to the gallery. Certainly many shows from the era had numbers in their title. We might think about other Castelli shows and also things like Three American Painters. The portfolio's name is perhaps, moreover, a self-historicizing riff. Although it contains the work of one more artist and relies on a distinct preposition, it is difficult not to link it to the groundbreaking Castelli Warehouse exhibition, 9 at Leo Castelli. This show was held the same year and in part organized by Robert Morris, the participant who makes the portfolio's 10th artist. 9 at Leo Castelli implied that the gallery could exist beyond its white cube location to occupy the specific site of a West Side warehouse. The portfolio arguably further expanded Castelli to an even greater range of exhibition sites, liberating the projects from the standards of gallery presentations. Indeed, Morris included a vacuum-molded plastic sculpture, Model, which, as its name suggests, is a tabletop mock-up of an earthwork. And the original for this work, Model for Project in Earth and Sod, will be familiar to some here as it was included in James Meyer's Virginia Dwan exhibition. At the time, so Dwan had her earthwork show at the same time the Castelli warehouse show was up, the critic Philip Leitner affirmed that it was in Morris in whom both earthworks and the Castelli exhibition meet. Hence, the industrially produced multiple perhaps conjures a range of sites or even non-sites. Visualizing networks. The February 1968 edition of SMS includes a content sheet recalling a wedding invitation. Another issue's contents mimic a check. Both the idea of a shared meal or the coming together of a social celebration of a couple speak to congregation. An egalitarian community spirit coursed through Copley's SMS. According to Mike Mizell's, quote, "Regardless of stature, each contributor was paid $100. The spirit continued to the communal atmosphere of Copley's Upper West Side letter-edged in black press loft, which functioned as an unofficial hangout for many of the participants," end quote. The final pages of Ting's publication consist of a collage group portrait of all the authors. They're united in the same lithographic ink. And in addition to connecting himself and his institution with the diverse painters involved, Wagstaff's thank yous reveal a broader network of galleries and donors who made his 10 by 10 project possible. So for the remainder of my time, I'm going to do a case study on EAT's New York collection for Stockholm. And this was a printed portfolio that accompanied a gift of a whole series of artworks to the Moderna Museet. So here we go. "We were a disorderly crowd of about 100, occupying the whole middle section of the 747's amphitheater. The bar on the plane was free too, and if you weren't smashed before you embarked, you could be embalmed asleep within an hour over the ocean. The trip was a gas, and I didn't mind helping to live out Billy's fantasy, Sweden, EAT, and art." With these words, the Village Voice's Jill Johnson describes the lavish, debauched, and politically charged days she spent in the Nordic capital for the inauguration of the New York Collection for Stockholm at the Moderna Museet. EAT, we recall, stands for Experiments in Art and Technology, a nonprofit organization promoting, quote, "the inevitable active involvement of industry, technology, and the arts." Billy was Billy Kluver, who, with fellow Bell Labs engineer Fred Waldhauer and the artists Robert Rauschenberg and Robert Whitman, co-founded EAT in 1967. Julie Martin, who would also become a central figure, joined the same year. The New York Collections for Stockholm was a dual-platform co-production. The primary component was a gift organized by EAT of 31 works by Manhattan-based artists selected for the Moderna by its director-curator, Pontus Hulten. Perhaps anticipating the logic of Kickstarter.com, EAT published an eponymous portfolio of multiples printed at Styra Studio. This tabletop twin constitutes a kind of group portrait, preview, publicity, and souvenir. It was sold to help fund the donation of artworks and other media by the same artists, and was exhibited in New York a couple of weeks before Stockholm's October 26th opening. It was both a celebration of the increasingly mobile post-studio artist and the mobility of dematerialized multiple works of art. New York Collection for Stockholm attempted to crystallize and fuse artistic networks and infused Sweden's premier modern museum with $700,000 worth of the best contemporary American art. And based on readings of both iterations of the collection, I'll explore the politics of the New York Collection and analyze the ways the portfolio can be considered equally a dematerialized double and a cybernetic social network. As far as EAT was concerned, a spirit of generosity and friendship underwrote the exchange. Referencing the two components, Kluver saw the New York Collection initiative as a kind of public good. He stated that, quote, "The gift represents an intelligent and sympathetic placement of American art abroad, which benefits the artist, art community, and museum public of both countries." However, returning to Johnson's assessment, an air of fantasy enshrined the affair too. As EAT was apparently oblivious of their initiative's entanglement with political, diplomatic, and economic interests. It came at a time when the U.S. had withdrawn its ambassador from Sweden, following Education Minister Olof Palme's participation in a 1968 anti-war protest with the North Vietnamese ambassador. Palme further alienated the U.S. by comparing American military actions in Vietnam to those of the Nazis. The U.S. Senator from New York, Jacob Javits, accompanied Kluver in the announcement of the New York Collection gift. Despite being a Republican, Javits had a progressive taste in art and had grown to oppose the Vietnam War. In a speech given in Stockholm, he stated, "The war, which was a cause for this strain, is now over. And I see manifestations of mutual cultural interest like this as a great means to improve the close bonds of our two countries," end quote. New York Mayor John Lindsay was named honorary chairman of EAT's project. Sweden's Princess Christina enthusiastically promoted the initiative and previewed the exhibition. The Swedish government contributed 500,000 kroner, about $100,000, and Volvo, Chase, Manhattan Bank, and various New York galleries were sponsors. Despite a common opposition to the Vietnam War by the New York Collection artists and most sponsors, ambivalence and skepticism marked the reception. It was viewed with suspicion by Swedish and American-based artists alike, an instance not so much of advanced art, but of its instrumentalization, or, as one Swede termed it, aesthetic imperialism. "Sure, we've been co-opted," lamented the German-American artist Hans Hacke in the Washington Post. The 1960s and 70s saw an increased interest in the employment of new technology for art. A number of period exhibitions showcased work in media more proper to the laboratory or factory than the gallery. Not completely unique, EAT was arguably one of the most important organizations that emerged with aspirations to integrate what C.P. Snow called the two cultures. Working to expand creativity across the art-science divide, EAT's diverse projects included performance series, exhibitions, and artworks. They also facilitated encounters between a network of visual artists, dancers, and scientists, and as well held field trips to laboratories. Martin considered EAT a kind of anti-institutional institution, a community providing spaces for moving, quote, outside the system and getting around the galleries and the dealers. Nine Evenings, Theater and Engineering, has probably provoked the spilling of the most ink or pixels of any EAT-related initiative. The program brought together 30 engineers and 10 artists. prompting the formalization of the group. Following the October 66 founding event, regional branches of EAT began to form all over the U.S. Indicative of both Senator Javits and EAT's flair for mediatic engagement, the politician gave a speech at the group's October 11, 1967 press conference launch at Robert Rauschenberg's loft at 361 Lafayette Street. EAT's central office subsequently produced Some More Beginnings at the Brooklyn Museum, which was conceived as a sibling exhibition to Pontus Hultin's Machine at the End of the Mechanical Age at the Museum of Modern Art. And EAT's Pepsi Pavilion for Osaka represented their most spectacular offering. Plans for another collaboration with Hultin, the New York Collection for Stockholm, began soon after their pavilion closed. Additionally, Marcel Duchamp, the creator of the Boîte, was associated with EAT. Billy Kluver took him to Bell Labs. And indeed, Robert Whitman translated the August Dadaist's ideas about taking the Woolworth Building as a ready-made into the photographic book cover that framed the exhibition's commemorative catalog. Duchamp's influence undoubtedly extended to the portfolio too, which includes a record by George Siegel entitled Remembrance of Marcel, which compares the father of Dada with Leonardo, the epitome of the scientist artist. According to Kluver, the portfolio is highly original and represents the quintessential expression of each artist. He continues in a Duchampian vein, affirming it is presentation and documentation, equally an exhibition and time witness in itself. The dematerialized double was not merely a carbon copy of the New York collection. The portfolio works, while undoubtedly related to art in the Moderna Museet made in New York, are not identical to the gallery projects. Instead, many deliberately mark linkages between distinct sites. So on the record cover is an image of the work that's actually in the museum. Possessing a deferred and belated temporality, some evoke the future contents of the museum, while others signal New York and America. Projects by Red Grooms and Larry Rivers celebrate Hultin and other EAT figures. Indeed, Grooms' EAT expedition image represents the social ligaments and predicts the wildness of the actual transatlantic trip during which Grooms served as an MC. Hans Hacke's 420 West Broadway visitors profile shows results of a political polling project held a year prior at the John Weber Gallery. Hacke conducted his poll in the fall of 1972, the same time the New York Collection for Stockholm works were exhibited simultaneously at the same address, which housed Castelli and Sonneben Galleries too. The exhibitions at 420 West Broadway coincided with an elaborate party Rauschenberg threw for Princess Christina. Hacke's work reveals the political leanings of the New York art world sympathetic to EAT's gift. George McGovern, the presidential candidate who overwhelmingly came out on top in his mock election, importantly ran on an anti-war platform. One of Rauschenberg's contributions to the portfolio is an untitled sketch for his breakthrough work Monogram, his most well-known combine, first shown at Castelli, but which has been in the Moderna Museet's collection since 1964. In 1973, the goat and tire appeared in the galleries with some other EAT donations, serving as a kind of mascot and metonym for Hultin's curatorial vision for acquiring work by New York-based artists. Alex Hayes' untitled screen print is almost identical to the canvas that entered the museum, except its surface is pocked with a series of markings and notations. Hay argues in the catalog, quote, "I have changed and the painting has changed. Otherwise, we would still be in the same place," end quote. Equally, with its simultaneous location in 300 portfolios, the work must have changed. Nam June Paik's printed project consists of a montage and diagram for the sculpture that entered the collection and incorporates schematic drawings for Paik's TV chair for the Moderna in tandem with a seemingly outmoded mass media quiz about TV. His untitled print is dedicated to Ray Johnson, who he calls the great communication artist, and perhaps recalls some of Johnson's use of collage. Hence, it spans multiple meanings of network. The work highlights a social connection and evokes broadcasting information with art, like on a television network. The print's quiz seems to encourage participation while poetically deterring the straight content it redeploys. Similarly, Roy Lichtenstein's work for the portfolio conjures up in fragments a variety of other mass-circulated images. The foreshortened finger thrust toward the spectator is equally interpolative and self-referential. Moreover, we might understand it as a deconstruction of powerful nationalistic figures. Aligning them with wider developments, a diagrammatic impulse runs through a significant number of the artworks in the portfolio, and to a certain extent, the gallery works. Diagrams are a curious and complex species of sign, which abstract away from immediate perception. Following Margaret Iverson, quote, artists of this period adopt the diagrammatic mode in order to register their sense of the impossibility of any spontaneous, unmediated gesture, while at the same time subtly subverting the coercive regimes of the diagrammatic, end quote. Hence, with this use and abuse of diagrams, the works try to wrest both artistic and scientific knowledge away from solely the rational and bellicose purposes of the military-industrial complex. This portfolio is also a diagram of a polity, the transnational network of EAT. Similarly, a number of projects poetically repurposed industrial elements for alternate ends. Initially, the New York Collection portfolio was issued in a Honduras mahogany box. During production, the deluxe material was declared endangered and banned, which forced a retooling of the container. And Robert Rauschenberg provided a solution. He designed a cardboard case to house the components. Corrugated card, the, quote, material of waste and softness, with its only message a collection of lines, as Rauschenberg described it, is typically used for containers for shipping all manner of goods and consumer durables around the globe. And it had been his primary medium since moving to Captiva Island in Florida in 1968. It appealed equally for its lowliness and the connections between diverse populations it implied. He remarked, quote, I still haven't been any place where there weren't cardboard boxes, even up the Amazon. Art historian Yves Alain Bois points out that cardboard only gets a second look in the moment it is about to be disposed or recycled. Quote, no great hermeneutic skills are necessary here. The discourse of the cardboard box is elementary. It has to be in order for the cardboard to function. The box's statement consists in the spelling out of its content, which is occasionally advertised with a logo or another diagrammatic icon, its place of origin, and sometimes the address of its destination. And indeed, some iterations of the New York collection did extend the diagrammatic tendency to the narrow box. With his humble vessel, Rauschenberg suggests both universality and a parity between art and other consumer durables. Like other products, advanced art could flow internationally as well. The still relatively new communications and replication technology of the Xerox copier enabled Warhol to dematerialize and decrease in fidelity an image of the iconic Chinese leader Mao Zedong. He based the work on a portrait from Mao's Little Red Book, and he had repurposed this first in 1972 in a time that coincided with Nixon's trip to China. Warhol realized the project, which distorts a legible image towards abstraction, by copying and recopying an image, enlarging and elongating it by 1 or 2% each time he pressed the button. Warhol's Mao can be read various ways. The Little Red Book was a de rigueur accessory for leftist radicals at the time. It was also one more consumer good. Warhol's copy job showed not all saleable products serve the system, and seems to critique a superficial engagement with the multiply reproduced and translated words of Mao. It also performs an interrogation of artistic labor and valuation. Warhol's signature turns an image produced via lowly office work on unremarkable paper stock into a valuable artwork. Finally, it could even be a form of guerrilla tactics, camouflage that introduces Mao, the bane of the right and an ideological opponent of the United States, clandestinely into a national collection. Writing a year in advance of the misfired messages of the Moderna Musée's presentation, critic Barbara Rose contends that the gift embodied the Gotham scene and solidified New York's reputation as a cosmopolitan hub for art. In 1973, Alex Hay also thought that networking was not necessarily compromised. Quote, sure, there's a kind of buddy system that controls things. It wasn't the foreign minister who brought me to this place. It was Billy Kluver, and Hulton is an ace. Hence, the New York Collection for Stockholm, and especially the portfolio, are network-made artworks, cybernetic exhibitions. Looking back on the initiative, EAT figure Robert Whitman described it as possessing the logic of treasury funds, a type of low-risk government bond. Quote, we could get art and give the government art, and they would give us money for the art. And surely it was part the funding sources that prompted Swedes to balk at the project and start asking whether it might have been better to support Swedish or even Vietnamese artists. Evincing their own discomfort with the project's reception, a number of the Americans remained in a steady state of intoxication from the moment they boarded the plane. Nonetheless, nearly all involved boycotted the party co-thrown by the U.S. Embassy and the U.S. Information Agency. However, with their art futures, an ambivalent example of mimicry and subversion, EAT was able to fund works that critiqued the status quo. They prompted the American government to help offer a gift to a country that had not agreed to its imperial program. The project was a noble effort to normalize relations between people who shared beliefs about the war waged in Indochina. Clearly, they were understood by some, such as Emile D'Antonio in the catalog essay, as, quote, an art of quality and radical politics. Unfortunately, the New York Collection for Stockholm and its portfolio exhibited the same qualities as some of the former's contents. The works in the museum had broken down by the end of the opening night. While driven by lofty ideals to reprogram art and science, as well as American international relations, the initiative was also liable to periodic malfunction. Faultiness aside, the New York Collection for Stockholm was not just an example of art as avant-garde engineering, but political engineering as well. And just as a brief conclusion, I think looking at these portfolios reveals ways that we might rethink received ideas about art historical taxonomies. Returning to period understandings about relationships between works in distinct media and styles provides us with new or renewed insights on art, both within and beyond the print room. These multiple editions might enable us to imagine historically grounded constellations of art that the strictures of style would otherwise blind us from. Thank you. And I'd be very happy to take questions or comments.
About in general when these were produced, of how much would these things be going for? You know, if they're clearly more affordable than works on, you know, painting, mm-hmm. and sculpture, but you know, how affordable are we talking?
So the most affordable is SMS, which you could get by subscription for $125 a year. So that was not much money. I think the others are already, even in their time, fairly expensively priced. I haven't been able to find concrete pricing on the others. But I think we're talking probably in the thousands for the others, if not high hundreds. I think really SMS that kind of fulfills its democratic mission by pricing it at a range that people could actually afford.
Like the example from the Wadsworth Athenaeum, and then like just a private person display it in the house. Do you know what were their lives afterwards, or did they primarily go into museum collections?
So a number of them have been held together. So it seems like there's, at least based on, and again, sort of beginning Google searches to see where these are, there are quite a number of institutions that have them. We actually have two copies of the 10x10, one that has been kind of reconfigured. Dave and Reba Williams I'm almost certain that it came from them, had put together a collection of these 10, but don't have the box set. So I think a lot of collectors got them and then split them apart. And even with 1 cent life, just looking for examples online to try and see in this search for prices that I ultimately need to do more work on. It seems like a lot of the 1 cent life pages, even though they have numbers on them, have been pulled apart and are getting sold individually. So I think there's a strong tendency for people to break them into pieces because they can get more money by reselling them that way. And so they haven't always been able to stay together.
I don't know if I understood correctly, but you said that some of the artists' intentions was to bypass gallerists and dealers, but Castelli is himself a gallerist and is sponsoring this whole one of the projects. Ethan Sam Wagstaff is very connected with both creating and gallerists in New York.
So I think that really is just true for SMS and EAT. That quote came from, sorry, this maybe wasn't clearer. That was a quote from Julie Martin, thinking about how the experiments in art and technology project might work. So it's maybe a little bit optimistic because, of course, they are dealing with galleries. They're celebrating their collaboration with the Moderna Museet in a building that was known at the time as the Pentagon because of the five major New York galleries that were inside of it. So it's maybe slightly wishful thinking. And I think you're exactly right that many of these, I think it's important to think about them as connecting quite directly to galleries. And I wanted to make clear that the Wadsworth and the Castelli seem to kind of extend the site of the gallery in some ways into domestic spaces.
I had a similar to your question about motivation. As far as, you know, thinking back to in the 20s when the Surrealists put together group portfolios to raise money to support people in the Spanish Civil War, and there's like political motivation. It's sort of an interesting arc to trace motivation. There's always this rhetoric of bringing art to the people, but then there's political fundraising, and I think particularly Once in Life, I didn't catch the motivation.
I think there it's largely Ting hoping to kind of launch his career in the United States, and he befriends Sam Francis, who's the kind of editor with him, and they then are able to get a whole series of artists, both pop artists and people working in more expressionist modes, to come together kind of in the name of pairing art and poetry and colliding those two things. But as you can see from, like, it's quite, I mean, he's a big character in this book. And so it maybe functions as a kind of promotional device for him. I didn't talk about it because it's not part of our collection, but there was in 68 also a portfolio of 25 prints for artists against racism and the war that was dedicated to Martin Luther King. So there are much like exhibitions such as those found at like Paula Cooper Gallery, where there's artists against the war. There is some more explicit politics to these portfolios that they do, like the Surrealist portfolios. There is perhaps more of just kind of lip service to radical causes, that there actually is a direct link. Yep.
Just one more thing about the Moderna Museet exhibition. I noticed it had a very short run. It was just about a month. Is that true?
That sounds about right to me.
That seemed very short for such a large, seemingly large project to bring these artists together. And I just didn't know what the future of that exhibition was there, if that prompted more collecting.
They were integrated into the permanent collection. So I'm sure some of them stayed on display. And I think in a number of cases, they have become kind of like iconic parts of that museum's of holdings. Certainly the Rauschenberg monogram appears again and again and again in their promotional materials. The other works maybe to a lesser extent, but I think because they were integrated into the permanent collection, a number of them stayed up even following that kind of discrete exhibition. All right, well, thank you again so very much for coming out.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.